Hello, this is Melanie Guralnick, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the December 7th, 2025 issue of the Toronto Sun on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. The first story is Katy Perry Goes Instagram Official with Justin Trudeau. That skirt was way too short. Pop star's outfit she wore to meet former Japanese PM caused stir. By Mark Daniel. Katy Perry has gone Instagram official with her boyfriend Justin Trudeau, posting loved-up photos from their trip to Tokyo. After Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida posted a photo of him and his wife posing with Trudeau, 53, and Perry, 41, on X, the pop star shared her own candid moments with the former Canadian Prime Minister. In one close-up, Perry and Trudeau smiled as they cozied up in an outdoor park setting. In another, the 13-time Grammy nominee ate a sushi roll while Trudeau looked on. The pair were also seen from behind as they took in a light-filled art exhibit. Quote, Tokyo Times on tour and more, smiley face, heart emoji, and other emojis I can't really tell what they are, Perry captioned her social media post. Perry is in Japan with her Lifetimes tour and joined Trudeau as he visited Kishida and his wife Yuko last week. The Japanese leader referred to Perry as Trudeau's partner in a social media post that marked the meeting. Quote, former Canadian Prime Minister at Justin Trudeau visited Japan with his partner and joined my wife and me for lunch, Kishida tweeted in Japanese alongside a photo of the couples. During his time as Prime Minister, we met multiple times as fellow leaders, and when I visited Canada, we worked together to strengthen bilateral relations, including formulating the Japan-Canada Action Plan, sweating it out side by side. I am delighted that we continue to maintain this friendship in this way. Trudeau reposted the photo, writing, Great to see you at Kishida 230. Katy and I were so glad to have the chance to sit down with you and Yuko. Thank you, Fumio, for your friendship and your continued commitment to both the international rules-based order and to a better future for everyone. But Perry's short-skirted outfit hit a sour note with some fans. Wouldn't kill her to consult a stylist if she will be the former head of the state's number one at official events, though. One critic swiped on X, with another commenting, I thought the same. That skirt was way too short. She should consult the Princess of Wales stylist. Now that woman knows how to dress for any occasion. Several others took issue with Kishida for referring to Perry as Trudeau's partner. Quote, You meant at Katy Perry and her partner, Mr. Kishida, one Perry fan clarified, as another added, that's Katy Perry, global pop icon. But after her breakup with ex-fiancé Orlando Bloom, with whom she shares five-year-old daughter Daisy Dove, earlier this year, many of Perry's 202 million followers cheered on her new romance. I just know that Justin is the new minister of her heart emoji, and we are so happy for that, one person commented on Instagram. Your happiness is our happiness. All the love to you, a second person added. Trudeau crazy about Perry. Trudeau and Perry first sparked dating rumors when they were spotted having dinner in Montreal in July. Shortly afterwards, photos and videos shared to social media showed Trudeau dancing and singing at Perry's concert at Montreal's Bell Centre, alongside his 16-year-old daughter, Ella Grace. In one video, Trudeau was seen belting out the lyrics to Perry's 2010 hit, Firework. The pair were then photographed in late September, hugging and kissing aboard Perry's yacht. They then celebrated Perry's 41st birthday at the Crazy Horse Paris and were photographed by TMZ, leaving the venue holding hands and smiling. Of course, Katie and Justin looked absolutely stunning together and appeared to be happier than clams, the website reported. An insider close to Perry told People that the whirlwind romance is a life twist that caught the pop star by surprise following her split from Bloom. Dating Justin is something she never saw coming, but she's really enjoying this surprising life twist, the Perry source said. Another source told Page Six that Trudeau is crazy about Perry. Quote, "He is crazy about her and thinks she is the perfect woman," the insider said in October. They are simpatico on everything, including politics, kids, and French food. But a third person suggested that Trudeau might be going through a midlife crisis as he romances Perry. Dating Katie may just be Justin's answer to going to Burning Man. It's a bit of a midlife crisis, the source told Page Six. As pictures of the couple made front-page news worldwide, Trudeau's ex, Sophie Grégoire, shared a cryptic message about letting go with her 371,000 Instagram followers. During an appearance on the Can't Be Censored podcast, Grégoire said commentary about Trudeau's new relationship feels like noise. In another chat with Arlene Dickinson's Arlene is Alone, The Single Life, Grégoire insisted she wasn't bothered by Trudeau's high-profile romance. "I don't know how you stay cool. I really admire it because I would probably not be that way," Dixon remarked. "You know, we're human beings and stuff affects us." "Normal," Grégoire responded. "How you react to stuff is your decision, so I choose to try and listen to the music instead of the noise." There is the picture that the Japanese Prime Minister posted to his Instagram and that Justin Trudeau did the same. The four of them are standing in front of a Christmas tree that's in front of a window and gold curtains on both sides. And you could see that Katie is wearing a brown jacket over a black shirt and a brown mini skirt with black see-through like pantyhose. It's very respectable, honestly. And Justin is in a gray suit, and the Prime Minister is also in a dark blue suit, and his wife is wearing a floral dress with a blue blazer over it. Photo courtesy of Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. That story was Katy Perry goes Instagram official with Justin Trudeau. "That skirt was way too short," by Mark Daniel. The next story is Air Transat Pilots Union issues 72-hour strike notice, airline to suspend flights, by Ling Hui. Air Transat passengers looking to fly to warm, sunny destinations this week could see their flights canceled, as the union representing 750 of the airline's pilots gave its 72-hour strike notice. The Airline Pilots Association, or ALPA, said its members will go on strike as early as Wednesday at 3 a.m., unless progress is made at the bargaining table. The pilots' union said it issued the strike notice after failing to find common ground following nearly a year of negotiations with travel company Transat AT Inc., which owns the Montreal-based airline. Air Transat scaling back operations. Calling the timing of the strike notice a reckless decision, Air Transat issued a release Sunday, saying it will gradually shut down its operations, suspending some flights on Monday and Tuesday. The airline called the strike notice premature, adding, "We have demonstrated a serious commitment throughout the process and a sincere willingness to reach an agreement by proposing several compromises and improvements that address the pilots' demands." Despite these efforts, ALPA has shown no openness, and the discussions have not led to an agreement. Air Transat said it had offered pilots a 59% salary increase over 5 years and major improvements to working conditions. The airline said passengers whose flights are canceled will be informed and directed them to visit airtransat.com /strike for more information. Strike vote garnered 99% support. On December 2, the airline's pilots voted 99% in favor of giving their union's governing body the authority to declare a strike, if necessary. Both sides said they remain committed to reaching an agreement that would avoid disruptions to customers. The union said it wants a new collective agreement to secure job security and to improve working conditions and compensation. There is still time to avoid a strike, but unless significant progress is made at the bargaining table, we will strike if that's what it takes to achieve a modern contract, Bradley Small, the union's Master Executive Council Chair, said in a statement. No pilot wants to strike, but Air Transat management has left us no choice, he added. Months of unproductive bargaining ends now. If we cannot reach an agreement, management will be responsible for every canceled flight and stranded passenger. That story was Air Transat Pilots Union issues 72-hour strike notice, airline to suspend flights, by Ling Hui. The next story is opinion. Crisanti, Toronto needs a course correction. Taxpayers deserve better. By Vincent Crisanti, special to Toronto Sun. I still remember the good old days when the taxpayers were in charge, and all Torontonians could rely on the consistent delivery of course services. Back then, people were confident that their local government was working for them. As Torontonians grapple with the thought of another property tax hike, they have simply lost faith in how it will benefit them. This year was especially tough for the city, marked by inadequate snow removal, pools closed on the hottest days of the year, unprecedented traffic congestion, and skyrocketing unaffordability. As we grow the size of government to deal with these issues, disappointment in council's inability to manage taxpayers' dollars lingers. Solutions seem to rely on adding more layers of bureaucracy, as reflected in the recent decisions to hire a czar to end traffic congestion, a czar to fight Toronto's rat infestation, and a chief resiliency officer to manage extreme weather events, accompanied by new staff to oversee the existing teams that already lead this work. It's enough to make taxpayers' heads spin. Clean streets, safe communities. The city has steered way off course. We're spending too much time changing names, removing lanes of traffic, and spending taxpayers' dollars to increase red tape when we should be focused on ensuring that there is a visible return on investment for every dollar we spend. People want clean streets, safe communities, and the guarantee of clean water when they turn the tap on. Even Toronto's longest contributors, the seniors who work their backs off to build our city, see little to no return from their tax dollars. At this point in their lives, they should not have to carry the burden of council decisions that are not aligned with providing better services. At the risk of sounding like a broken record, we need to readjust our focus back to the taxpayers. Under no circumstances should safe and clean communities, reliable transit, and affordability be ploys for another property tax increase on the backs of hardworking people. We must find real long-term efficiencies in our system. Cut the distractions and redirect the savings to the front lines so Torontonians can stop feeling underserved. Tough choices. I've been hearing from my constituents, and they demand better. As Council heads into the 2026 budget process, it is crucial that we ensure our decisions deliver real value for money. This begins with making the difficult choices that we have not been prepared to do. Continuing to reach into people's pockets is the easy way out. The real work is in the responsible management of taxpayers' dollars. It's tough, but that's how things get done. There is a picture of the ice rink at Nathan Phillips Square by City Hall in Toronto. And you can see that the ice rink doesn't have anyone on it at the moment, but there is a big letters that say Toronto in blue. There is a red maple leaf, and there are two tall buildings behind it that are lit blue from beneath. Photo courtesy of Ernest Dorosuk via the Toronto Sun. That story was Opinion. Chris Santi. Toronto needs a course correction. Taxpayers deserve better. By Vincent Crisanti. The next story is People in these Canadian cities are having the most winter affairs. For non-monogamy's sake, the reward is higher than the risk. By Danette Wilford. Ashley Madison released its list of the top 10 Canadian cities that are ready for some non-monogamous action. The hotspots for those cold, unfaithful nights surprisingly don't include big cities like Toronto or Vancouver, which have topped previous charts. Rather, it's the smaller locales that boasted the highest concentration of new sign-ups in November, according to new data from the online dating service. Doesn't everyone know everyone else's business? In smaller or mid-sized towns, people may feel social expectations more intensely because everyone knows everyone. Sex and relationship therapist Tammy Nelson told the Toronto Sun. There can be pressure to present a certain image to the outside world, she explained. When couples feel stuck in those roles, they may look for connection, excitement, or emotional validation outside of the relationship, sometimes discreetly, because it feels like a private place to breathe. Why chance it? But instinctively, one would find that odd, or sus, as the kids say, given that the smaller the town, the higher the chances are for an awkward run-in or match-up with someone familiar. Nelson agreed, but noted that sometimes, and for non-monogamy's sake, the reward is higher than the risk. It seems counterintuitive, but the elevated risk of exploring non-monogamy within a small town can be part of the motivation, she noted. It isn't always about sex. When people choose to date outside their primary relationship, it isn't always about sex, Nelson continued. Sometimes it could feel like breaking out of a role and doing so in a discreet way is more comfortable and a way to avoid gossip or judgment. So, while you might see people sneaking away for quickies in cars, Ashley Madison isn't only about the physical. Rather, it's that connection that some feel they're missing. And if they find it with someone and keep it strictly digital, sometimes that is enough to scratch that itch. In rural and mid-sized communities, people often feel isolated, Nelson said. Without access to diverse communities, like different social groups or open relationship hangouts, online platforms can be the only outlet. She added, "People tend to know who in their geographic area is open-minded, who is curious, or who is practicing non-monogamy. Word travels. Online apps that offer discretion can make non-traditional dating more accessible for those looking to explore." These are the top Canadian locales for non-monogamy, according to Ashley Madison. Victoria, BC. Barrie, Ontario. Peterborough, Ontario. Kelowna, BC. Kingston, Ontario. Kamloops, BC. Belleville, Ontario. Fredericton, NB. Lethbridge, ALTA. And Moncton, NB. That story was People in These Canadian Cities Are Having the Most Winter Affairs by Danette Wilford. The next story is Peel Cops Thwart Robbery Attempt at Erin Mills Mall. Two dead in Highway 400 crash. Peel police say four youth suspects were rounded up within minutes of them fleeing from Mississauga Mall. By Jordan Ersett. Peel Regional Police made quick work of an attempted robbery last week at Erin Mills Town Center, rounding up four teenage suspects within 3 minutes of them fleeing from the Mississauga Mall. Police said four hammer-wielding thugs, wearing masks and all-black clothing, were spotted entering the mall at Erin Mills Parkway and Eglinton Avenue on Wednesday at about 2:50 p.m. Security personnel and an on-site paid-duty officer pursued them. One of the suspects was nabbed by security, while the three other suspects allegedly fled in a stolen Honda CR-V, which was quickly spotted by officers from the 11th Division Community Intervention and Response Team. Police said patrol officers boxed in the vehicle to prevent a pursuit and arrested the other three suspects after a brief chase on foot. No injuries were reported, and no property was taken from the mall, according to police. Police also said they linked the group to an earlier robbery attempt in York Region. These four allegedly tried to rob a store in York a couple hours before this. Constable Tyler Bell Marina says in a video of the arrest posted to the Peel Police social media account. Didn't work out for them either, but at least we caught them here in Peel. Four teenage boys, ages 14 to 17, face charges of robbery, attempt to commit an indictable offense, possession of property obtained by crime, and two counts of disguise with intent. They cannot be named under the provisions of the Youth Criminal Justice Act. Two dead after crash on Highway 400. Two men are dead, and another male suffered injuries after a Sunday morning crash that shut down Highway 400 in Vaughan for several hours. The OPP GTA traffic social media account said the collision involving a passenger vehicle and transport truck happened on the 400 near Major McKenzie Drive early in the morning. Three men were in the passenger vehicle, CP24 reported. Two passengers in the rear of the vehicle, both men in their 30s from Bradford, were pronounced dead at the scene, while the driver, a 50-year-old man from Toronto, was hospitalized with critical injuries. The driver of the transport was uninjured, CP24 reported. Investigators said the vehicle, which was operating as a rideshare, hit a guardrail while exiting the highway before colliding with the tractor-trailer, the Canadian Press reported. Two people hurt after tent fire. Another tent fire in Toronto has left two people injured, according to police. Toronto police said on social media that they received reports of heavy black smoke at about 12:20 p.m. in the Cherry Street, Unwin Avenue area, near Cherry Beach, adding that a tent appeared to be on fire. The fire was under control less than an hour later, with two people suffering non-life-threatening injuries. The incident happened less than a week after a woman was found on fire inside a tent in the Lakeshore Boulevard and 8th Street area of Etobicoke. Hope I said that right. The woman, whose age wasn't immediately released, was transported to a hospital via an emergency run, and a police officer was also hospitalized with minor injuries. That story was Peel Cops Thwart Robbery Attempt at Erwin Mills Mall, Two Dead in Highway 400 Crash by Jordan Ursit. The next story is Sex Files. Meet Fubbing, a silent relationship killer. Fubbing is the new quiet relationship killer, says Lisa Chen, a relationship expert and couples therapist, by Simone Paget. A couple of years ago, my friend was living with a man we'll call Jake. It took her a few years to realize that he was already in a relationship. Not with another woman, but with his smartphone. Entire evenings would pass with him barely acknowledging her with little more than a grunt, his face glued to his screen. His behavior sent her into a tailspin of insecurity, making her feel that whatever content he was consuming on his phone was more important than their connection. It got so bad that the only way she could discuss relationship issues was by text message, even if they were sitting side by side, a revelation that nearly made my head explode. There's a word for this kind of diabolical behavior, phubbing. That's phubbing. While it's more common in long-term relationships, it can also wreak havoc on the early stages of dating. What is phubbing? Phubbing is the new quiet relationship killer, says Lisa Chen, a relationship expert and couples therapist. When one person snubs the other in favor of their phone screen, Chen says, it sends an unintentional signal that they don't care about their partner. It may feel rude to be on the receiving end of phubbing, but the motivations behind phubbing go deeper than just bad manners. For many, phubbing is a coping mechanism when they feel stressed, need a break, or are emotionally overloaded. It can reflect an avoidant attachment pattern where the distraction feels safer than being with their own emotions or another's emotions, says Chloe Bean, LMFT, a somatic trauma therapist who specializes in attachment wounds, high-functioning anxiety, and toxic relationship patterns in women and couples. While the intention behind phubbing may not be malicious, partners experience it as abandonment because it replicates the feeling of, I am not chosen by this person right now, or I am not important enough to keep their attention, explains Bean. Phubbing doesn't create insecurity, but it can activate old wounds. In the case of my friend, it triggered childhood abandonment issues and cracks in her self-esteem that made her question whether she was enough. It also fueled paranoia. Who was he talking to if he wasn't talking to her? That said, not all screen time in a relationship is problematic. Most of us have FOMO, and we are unnecessarily dependent on our devices, reminds Chen. For some, spending time on their phone can be a way to decompress after a long day or to take a breather from being overstimulated. After all, who hasn't lost themselves in TikTok cooking videos or a Reddit-fueled rabbit hole when they need a break? It becomes a red flag when someone consistently chooses their phone over being in the present moment or over opportunities for emotional connection, says Bean. The strongest indicator that your partner's screen time has become an issue in your relationship is feeling lonely even when sitting next to them. There's still time to turn things around. The good news is that you're currently experiencing this in your relationship. There's still an opportunity to turn things around. Bean says this starts with naming the behavior pattern instead of blaming the person. For example, instead of saying, you're always on your phone, say, when you scroll during dinner, I feel far away and disconnected from you. Can we talk about your day? Using I statements gives the other person the opportunity to understand how their behavior impacts you. The next step is to set boundaries and create small pockets of phone-free time throughout the day. For example, no phones during mealtime or shared activities. Bean also suggests that couples use the last 30 minutes before bed for a phone-free activity, either together or separately. Partners could use this time to talk and share moments of gratitude from each other's days. These repair and connect rituals create more co-regulation opportunities that soothe the insecure or anxious partner and create more stability for when the phone use is present, says Bean. Lastly, to Nick's phubbing, it's crucial to identify the why behind the behavior. Is screen time providing relief from anxiety, boredom, and overwhelm? Or is there something else going on? Speaking to a licensed therapist can help couples parse this out. As Bean reminds us, when couples understand each other's nervous systems and how they each respond to stress, their empathy can increase and defensiveness drops, making space for deeper connection. That story was Sex Files, Meet Fubbing, A Silent Relationship Killer by Simone Paget. The next story is Minnesota Fats, How $1 Billion Fraud Bolstered Somali Terrorists by Brad Hunter. Minnesota is having a Canadian moment. It's that point where diaspora politics crosses the line into something darker, more sinister, beyond festivals and food. A place where any criticism will get you tagged with the scarlet letter R, as in racist. Now, U.S. President Donald Trump is zeroing in on a $1 billion welfare fraud in the Gopher State and its biggest beneficiary, Somalians. At the heart of the president's gripes is a breathtaking scam with hundreds of millions of dollars siphoned from the U.S. government through the Somali community via bogus programs. Some of the cash was then directed to Islamic terrorists in Africa. Trump posted on Truth Social, quote, "Minnesota, under Governor Tim Walz, is a hub of fraudulent money laundering activity. I am, as President of the United States, hereby terminating, effective immediately, the Temporary Protected Status, or TPS program, for Somalis in Minnesota. Send them back to where they came from. It's over." All caps. Here's what you need to know. Land of 10,000 lakes. Minnesota shares a border with Ontario and has a population of around 5.8 million. About 60% of the residents live in the Twin Cities, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Much of the rest of the state is covered by lakes, prairie, and farmland. The state traditionally votes Democratic and offers top-tier social assistance and easy access to welfare. The weather was not the drawing card. The welfare was. Somalians began arriving in the state in the early 1990s, fleeing their home country's bloody civil war and frequent political upheavals. They are now the state's largest diaspora community with around 61,000 people, and with almost all residing in the Twin Cities. Scams galore. During the COVID-19 pandemic, a child nutrition program operated by the Feeding Our Future NGO, which had deep ties to the Somali community, was implicated in an alleged $300 million fraud with more than 70 defendants. The Justice Department called it the largest COVID-19 fraud scheme in the country. People created companies that billed the Minnesota government for meals that were never delivered. Instead, the cash went into the owners' pockets, luxury homes, cars, and travel. In August, a Somali-born leader of the scam was sentenced to 28 years in prison. During the trial, bags of money were left at the homes of jurors. More? In September, 8 people were charged with wire fraud for allegedly ripping off the now-defunct Housing Stabilization Services program by billing Medicaid for about $8 million by offering drug addicts assistance in their search for housing. Nearly all remain homeless. The next target for fraud was Minnesota's autism program. A Somali woman and accused co-conspirators allegedly falsely certified children to qualify for autism programs and handed their parents payoffs for their cooperation. The defendant intends to plead guilty. Autism centers jumped from a handful to hundreds in the few short years. From Feeding Our Future to Housing Stabilization Services and now Autism Services, these massive fraud schemes form a web that has stolen billions of dollars in taxpayer money, former U.S. Attorney for Minnesota Joseph Thompson said. Each case we bring exposes another strand of this network. Funding fanatics. Most frightening isn't the McMansions, the hookers, or the Ferraris. It's terrorism. A report from the Manhattan Institute claimed to connect money flowing out of Minnesota to the fanatical terror group Al-Shabaab, citing federal counterterrorism sources. An estimated $1.7 billion was allegedly sent to Somalia from the diaspora in 2023 alone. That's more than Somalia's annual budget. More troubling is that some of those millions allegedly found their way to Al-Qaeda's junior varsity squad, Al-Shabaab. Law enforcement sources told the City Journal the loot runs through a network of hawalas, informal clan-based money traders, then into the hands of terrorists. Squad rhymes with fraud. The most prominent Somali American and the queen bee in the Twin Cities is the far-left Democratic Congresswoman Ilhan Somalia First Omar. Not much happens in the community without her knowledge, and that's become a problem. Omar's alleged ties with the $1 billion welfare scam in her district are closer than this. She allegedly held parties at one of the restos involved in the food fraud and was tight with one of its now convicted owners. One of her own staff members was also convicted of stealing millions. She has been tight-lipped about the fraud the FBI calls the largest welfare scam in U.S. history. It was Omar who introduced the bill that led to $250 million in fraud. Yet she claims to have been completely unaware of it. Quote, Representative Omar knew who these people were. People she personally knew were making tens of millions of dollars in this program. Bill Gaughan, a policy fellow with the Minnesota-based Center of the American Experiment, claimed to the New York Post. She had been inside the safari facility on numerous occasions and couldn't put two and two together. Either she's terminally naive or knew and didn't care. Fun fact, the fraud network was centered in Omar's 5th congressional district, where 60 of the 79 alleged scammers indicted lived. Walls closing in. Was Governor Tim Walz stupid or incompetent? Nearly 500 current staffers in the state's Department of Human Services are alleging the failed vice presidential candidate was 100% responsible for the massive fraud. Staffers looped the governor in early on, but instead of action, he systematically retaliated against whistleblowers using monitoring, threats, repression, and did his best to discredit fraud reports. There was also a touch of Canada and the UK grooming scandals when red flags were raised. It was simple. You were a racist. The R word. As a result, whistleblowers have claimed the fear of being labeled a racist meant government officials were hesitant to prosecute the scheme to its full extent early on. When you raise your hand and call this into question, you get handed the racism card. Former Minnesota legislator David Gaither, who ran an adult education center for Somali immigrants, told the Post. You're shamed and put into a corner, especially if you're some mid-level bureaucrat. You're told to take some remedial training and look the other way. Have you seen our demographics? That's the approach the beleaguered Democrats are taking. The whole affair and Trump's comments are, racist. Quote, The Somali community have a distrust of norms in our society, like Minnesota nice. They're conditioned to ripping off the government because that's what goes on in Somalia, added Gaither. That story was Minnesota Fats, How $1 Billion Fraud Bolstered Somali Terrorists, by Brad Hunter. The next story is Raptors Avoid Humiliation, but Can't Complete Comeback Against Celtics, by Ryan Wolstadt. The Toronto Raptors played some of their worst and best basketball of the season, all in the same game on Sunday afternoon. The visiting Boston Celtics scored 75 points on them in the first half, built up a lead as big as 23, and appeared to be on the way to an easy win before things surprisingly shifted, and Toronto actually took the lead briefly in the fourth quarter. In the end, a rolling Celtics team, wins in 10 of 12, survived and handed Toronto its fifth loss in six games. But the Raptors at least woke up and made it close, showing some heart in the 121-113 defeat. Instead of rallying from possibly the worst performance of the season Friday against Charlotte, the Raptors got bullied, outworked, and were completely outclassed by the Celtics, who launched three-pointer after three-pointer and moved the ball around beautifully early. With the full NBA spotlight set to shine on the team on Tuesday for its NBA Cup semifinal game against the New York Knicks, it looked like that one might be an ugly spectacle based on how they were playing. But Brandon Ingram, 30 points, and Scotty Barnes, 18 plus 11 rebounds and 8 assists, were strong. Several little-used reserves stepped up, and a complete disaster was averted. They were not the same guys. Energy was different. Raptors head coach Darko Rajkovic said of what changed in the second half. Urgency was different. Couple other guys stepped up over there in the second half and helped us. I'm demanding more urgency from the whole team, demanding more scrappiness, because when we do that like we did it in the second half, we're a completely different team, and we can compete with any team in this league. We just got to do that over the course of 48 minutes. It cannot be just one half, Rajkovic said. More takeaways from a strange afternoon for the Raptors. False advertising. Most thought this would be a gap year for the Celtics, since perennial MVP candidate Jason Tatum was expected to be lost for the season, as he recovers from a right Achilles tear suffered in May. The thinking was they would struggle without Tatum and off-season cast-offs such as Kristaps Porzingis, Jrue Holiday, and Al Horford, and would settle for a high draft pick and return to contender status next year. Instead, Tatum has been working to a return at some point, and Boston has vastly exceeded expectations, with Jaylen Brown averaging 29 points a game. He had 30 on Sunday. And the team averaging the second most points per 100 possessions in the NBA, with the fifth best net rating, points per 100 minus points allowed per 100 possessions. They attempted 47 three-pointers to 21 for the Raptors and made 20 of them. Sunday's win put them ahead of the Raptors for third in the East, and they're inexplicably right back in the mix in a weak conference. They're elite in pick and rolls, and they're elite three-point shooting team. And how they create that is just through simple pick and roll action and just simple passes to create closeouts, Rajkovic said. So they're a really hard matchup. Hitting a rut. Sophomores Jamal Sheed and Jacoby Walter have both had their moments for the Raptors, but it has been tough sledding for them lately. Sheed came into Sunday shooting 26% from the field over his last 10 games, including 20% on three-pointers, and Walter was at 36% over his previous seven. Sheed missed his first five shots against Boston, but hit a big three-pointer that made a game that had long been a blowout to a three-possession one, and also hit three of his next four shots. Sheed said Rajkovic has stayed in his corner. We've had a lot of conversations. I can't be in my own world or own bubble. These guys need me to be a vocal leader and energy giver. Just be myself every night. We've had conversations about it. It's what you do outside of here. I've got to get some more rest. I've got to get my body better and just all around be a better professional, she'd said. Walter and fellow wing Grady Dick were all but invisible. Barrett news on the way. Raptors head coach Darko Rajakovic said before the game that R.G. Barrett's status would be updated Monday after practice. Barrett has missed 8 games since suffering a non-contact knee injury, though he's poked his head in to say hello to at least a couple of post-game media gatherings. In the first 7 games without Barrett, Toronto had been the worst offensive team in basketball, 30th in offensive rating, effective field goal percentage, and true shooting percentage. That's not all because of Barrett not playing, of course, but his play style and finishing ability has been missed. A return this week would be a major lift for a struggling team. Rajakovic tried something new, playing fellow Canadian A.J. Lawson on Sunday. Lawson, a bright spot last season in a campaign without many, had been averaging 25 points a game in the G League for unbeaten Raptors 905. He scored 7 points in his first 7 minutes of the season against the Celtics, and has some similarities stylistically with Barrett in how he can run the floor and cut to get open well, and also provides more of a consistent outside shooting threat to the mix. With Jamison Battle injured, playing Lawson made even more sense. Lawson finished with 10 points and 5 fouls in 13 minutes. Ochai Agbaji added 11 in 22 minutes. Everyone loves Chris. Celtics reserve Chris Boucher received a warm reception just before tip-off. It was his first game back after signing with the Celtics as a free agent after 406 games with Toronto, 12th on the franchise's career games played list, and ahead of the likes of Vince Carter, OG Anunoby, and Antonio Davis. Boucher was the last link to the championship team and one of the best stories in franchise history, having made the team out of Las Vegas Summer League and becoming one of the premier reserves they have employed. Boucher waved to the crowd after the tribute video was played. Unfortunately for Boucher, who didn't get into the game, he hasn't found much of a role yet in Boston, appearing in only 8 games and averaging just 11.4 minutes. That story was, Raptors avoid humiliation, but can't complete comeback against Celtics, by Ryan Wohlstadt. The next story is, TTC's Finch West Line opens to public 2 years late, $1.2 billion over budget, by Jordan Ursett. The TTC's delayed and over-budget Finch West Line opened to the public Sunday with a ceremonial first run filled with elected officials and free fares for riders throughout the day. The 10-kilometer LRT project is the city's first new transit line since 2002, but has cost about $1.2 billion more than the original estimate from Metrolinx and open up about 2 years later than its initial 2023 start date. But that didn't stop the TTC from celebrating the moment with Mayor Olivia Chow, Etobicoke North MP John Zeruccelli, Ontario Transportation Minister Prabhmeet Sarkaria, TTC Chair Jamal Myers, Metrolinx CEO Michael Lindsay, and TTC CEO Mandeep Lally boarding a train for a ceremonial first run. The TTC also handed out commemorative coins to the first 100 customers at Finch West Station and the first 50 customers at other stations along the route. Great day for transit users, Chow says. Chow said the new line means residents can get home and to work faster. Today is a great day for transit users, especially those in the northwest of the city, who now have a dedicated transit line to connect them to work, school, and home, Chow said in a news release. Line 6 services 18 stations between Humber College and Finch West Station. While connecting to the Line 1 subway system, 30 bus routes, and regional transit lines like GO Transit, Mississauga My Way, York Region Transit, and Brampton ZUM. Rush hour trains to run every 6.5 minutes. Trains are expected to depart every 6.5 minutes during weekday rush hours and every 10 to 12 minutes at other times. We're very excited to be opening Line 6 Finch West today, the most significant expansion of Toronto's transit network since the Spadina subway extension, said Myers, who is also the city councillor for Scarborough North. Thousands of riders will now benefit from faster connections to communities, jobs, and schools. Project faced numerous delays since 2007 proposal. The line was first proposed in 2007, during then-Mayor David Miller's tenure at City Hall, but was delayed by years of political debates, changes in funding, and repeated construction setbacks, which generated criticism from locals in the area, the Canadian Press reported. Construction on the LRT system began in 2019, and it was originally slated to open in 2023. A report by Metrolinx earlier this fall said the line's total cost was $3.7 billion, including life cycle, operating, and maintenance costs, putting the project well above the initial $2.5 billion estimate. The same report also showed the Eglinton Crosstown LRT, a delay-plagued project also first proposed in 2007, has incurred a cost of over $13 billion. Premier Doug Ford said earlier this week the Eglinton Crosstown system is expected to open in 2026. Construction began on that line in 2011, and it was first expected to open in 2020. September was later touted as a possible opening date, but performance issues pushed that timeline back further. That story was TTC's Finch West Line opens to public 2 years late, $1.2 billion over budget, by Jordan Ursett. The next story is Cinnabon worker fired after video of racist rant at customers goes viral, by Ling Hui. Warning, offensive language. A Cinnabon employee in Wisconsin has been fired after she was caught on video using a racist slur to customers. In the video posted on TikTok on Friday, a white female employee at a Cinnabon location in Ashwaubenon, Wisconsin, is seen using the N-word and cursing at two customers who were reportedly from Somalia. At one point, she declares, "I am racist," flashing her middle fingers and telling the customers to suck it. She then tells the two to leave in the expletive-filled rant. In a statement issued on social media Saturday, Cinnabon called the video disturbing, adding that the franchise does not condone this behavior. The former employee was immediately terminated by the franchise owner. "Their actions do not reflect our values or the welcoming experience every guest deserves." Incident sparked by customer's order. The TikTok user, who posted the video, told the Associated Press the incident happened on Friday in a mall in Ashwaubenon, a suburb of Green Bay. The woman said she was at the Cinnabon with her husband and had asked the employee to add more caramel on a caramel pecan cinnamon roll she had ordered. The woman said she started recording the heated exchange when the worker started lashing out at her and mocking her hijab. A GoFundMe campaign set up to support the customers described them as a, quote, black Somali Muslim couple who have been traumatized by the incident. Meanwhile, a GiveSendGo page that reportedly raised thousands of dollars for the fired woman has since apparently been taken down. There is a picture of that woman who works at Cinnabon It's just a still picture from the video where she's denigrating the two customers. She's got very long, straight blonde hair, wearing a tan shirt, and giving a weird look. Photo by at Daily Papus via TikTok. That story was Cinnabon worker fired after video of racist rant at customers goes viral by Ling Hui. The next story is Zoran Mom Donnie tells immigrant New Yorkers about their right not to comply with ICE by the Associated Press. New York. New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mom Donnie posted a video to social media on Sunday explaining immigrants' right to refuse to speak to or comply with agents from U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, days after federal agents carried out a raid in Manhattan. In the video, Mom Donnie vowed to protect the city's 3 million immigrants, saying, "We can all stand up to ICE if you know your rights." He explained that people in the U.S. can choose not to speak to federal immigration agents, film them without interfering, and refuse their requests to enter private spaces. ICE agents cannot enter spaces like a home, school, or private area of a workplace without a judicial warrant signed by a judge, Mom Donnie said. ICE is legally allowed to lie to you, but you have the right to remain silent. If you're being detained, you may always ask, "Am I free to go?" repeatedly until they answer you, said Mom Donnie, who will be sworn in as mayor on January 1. His comments came a week after demonstrators gathered as ICE attempted to detain people on Canal Street near New York's Chinatown. A similar immigration sweep in the same neighborhood last October was also met with protests. "New York will always welcome immigrants, and I will fight each and every day to protect, support, and celebrate our immigrant brothers and sisters," Mom Donnie said in Sunday's video. Weeks earlier, Mom Donnie had a surprisingly cordial Oval Office meeting with President Donald Trump, whose administration is carrying out federal immigration enforcement operations in several U.S. cities, most recently in New Orleans. That story was Zoran Mom Donnie tells immigrant New Yorkers about their right not to comply with ICE by the Associated Press. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the December 7, 2025 issue of the Toronto Sun. Your reader has been Melanie Guralnick. Thank you for listening.